Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM, Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. My name is Bob. This show happens every Sunday night, 7:30 to 9 p.m. If you listened last week, I had a special show. I did part one of an interview with a singer named and songwriter named Billy Miller, who was in a bunch of different groups. And we're going to start off the show with the rest of that interview. So first of all, Billy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Thanks for being on the radio a second time to finish telling your interesting story. So where we left off last week was we were talking about a group you were in called Billy and the Highliners. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you were a Milwaukee group. And, again, Billy and the Highliners, who were the members of that group?
Two brothers, Floyd Darcy, just still living in Milwaukee, and his brother, William, who has passed away, and female Betty Bias, and myself.
Okay, and last week we played the one record that was released by Billy and the Highliners, and it was called Lonely World and Scout. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And around when did that record come out?
I would say around 68.
Okay. Yeah, you were talking about how there was an article in Muhammad Speaks, Elijah Muhammad Speaks paper about you recording it, and it was like from in January of 68, so it was probably released near the time you recorded it. Is that correct?
Yeah, because we recorded it January 5th of 68.
And it probably came out like a month or something later?
Yeah, that's correct.
And I remember you were talking about your friend called you up and heard it on the radio, and your sister went to the store and bought a copy. Is that correct?
Yeah, my sister Ella McKinley, she told me that she went to the record store and bought one. No, she bought, you said, one for each one of my children. And, you know, didn't realize it, but people, big men, the Beatles, people like that, their managers would go and buy thousands of records. So it would get on the chart, and then it would get more airplay. And who, you know, have no money to do that kind of thing. That's how, and then people give money under the table, payola, to have the record played. But it still got a lot of airplay.
It's funny, the record label actually was called Airplay, too. Did you have a manager at the time?
No, we didn't. I managed the group.
So, did you start getting more shows after you had a record out, or what happened?
Basically, it's pretty much the same as far as I can recall.
Okay. Your phone, it's cutting out a little bit. I don't know if there's a better place where you have better reception. But you did do shows, is that correct?
Yes, we did. We traveled around Wisconsin doing shows. Can you hear me any better?
Yeah, it's better now. So you traveled around Wisconsin. Did you do the college circuit? Did you do mostly Milwaukee? What did you do?
Pretty much around local areas and downtown Milwaukee. I do recall us going somewhere during the winter, and my vehicle broke down. I don't remember much more than that, but we got to wherever we were supposed to go and did the show.
And what were your shows like?
Oh, how do you mean?
Like, well, first of all, you didn't have a band, so you had to rely on the house band at every club. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So you had three guys and a girl. Was there, like, a specific, like, popular act that you tried to emulate with that, like the Fifth Dimension? Or was there any, like, specific sound that you did a lot of songs of, like, a specific group or type of sound?
Well, the top 15 or 20 hits that was on the radio, and the Dorsey Brothers, they come out of a group called the Comic Books, and they, you know, would make you laugh and just stuff like that.
So they would they tell jokes, or you would just do, like, novelty-type songs, or they would act crazy during your shows? What would happen?
Yeah, they'd just act a little crazy.
Okay. But you weren't doing, you weren't performing full time, were you?
No, we weren't performing full time.
How often did you do shows?
Well, every weekend.
And how long did the group stay together?
I think a couple of years. I think in 70 or 71, Floyd had been doing a lot of Sammy Davis Jr. stuff. Candyman and songs that Sammy was known for recording. And then William, his brother, he just quit, and me and Betty ended up by ourselves. And I went to Chicago, tried to get somebody interested in me and Betty, and my brother-in-law, Sylvester Neely, was involved in record stores and music, and he introduced me to Jim Porter.
Okay, and so what? So at the time, did you have an? You were together with Betty. Did you, were you still calling yourself the Highliners? What was happening?
No, we was going as Billy and Betty.
So did you continue to perform just with Betty before you went and recorded, or you decided, oh, well, we're going to cut a record and then we're going to start doing shows? What happened?
Yeah, we cut the record first, and Jim Porter would have us go around promoting it in Chicago, and I would try to promote us in Milwaukee. And, you know, I investigated a little bit myself after talking to you, and saw that Greg Perry wrote "Talking About You, Baby."
Yeah, I saw. I noticed that on the record.
Yeah, and I've been reading a lot of biographies of other artists. And I just got through reading about Mary Wells, and when she left Motown and was looking for a new producer, she recorded an album called In and Out of Love, and Greg Perry was her producer. So that made me feel good to know that there was somebody that really had some connections and believed in me and Betty.
Was he just working for Jim Porter? Do you remember meeting him back then?
Yes, he taught me and Betty at the piano the song "Talking About You, Baby," and I don't remember anything other than that. He taught me what the, you know, the melody and the words, and taught Betty.
Okay, so do you remember when you recorded that in Chicago, and Jim Porter set up the recording? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you remember when you recorded it?
No, I don't. I would think about 70 or 71.
Okay. Can I play the record and then we'll talk a little bit more?
Yes, you betcha.
Okay. So this is Billy and Betty. And what was Betty's name? Last name again?
Bias.
So Billy Miller and Betty Bias, credited on the record as Billy and Betty. And this track is called "Talking About You, Baby." Okay, if you're just tuning in, that was Billy and Betty with Talking About You, Baby. And we are in the middle of a phone interview with Billy, who is Billy Miller, talking about his career and the different groups he sang with. So that record, you said it came out around 70, 71, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And did that record get any radio play?
Oh, yes. Gary McNutt and I worked together. We worked at a place that produced heavy water heights and stuff called Johnson Control.
In Milwaukee?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I remember writing that song in between working, and I got stuck. And I asked him, what did he think would go to complete this sentence? And he helped me. And so I gave him credit on the writing. And he used to, you know, take me to work and take me home when my car broke down. But I heard the record, and he did too, and I started getting a lot of attention on the job.
So you're talking about the song, because I thought you were talking about Greg Perry writing. Were you talking about You, Babe, or I Need Some Kind of Something?
I Need Some Kind of Something.
Okay. So Talking About You, Babe was the side written by Greg Perry, and I Need Some Kind of Something was written by you and someone named Gary McNutt. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So which side was the side that got radio play?
I Need Some Kind of Something.
Okay, so I just played the wrong side. It's still a good song, though. So did that get play in Milwaukee and Chicago, do you know?
Yes, it did. Matter of fact, I got the idea from listening to this disc jockey, very popular disc jockey that would be playing records. And he was talking about, I don't have nothing. I need some kind of something. And I said, that could be a title of a song. That's how I come up with that song.
Was it a Milwaukee DJ or a Chicago DJ?
Yeah. Yes, it was a Milwaukee DJ. O.C. White, I think his name was.
Okay. So the side, I'll play it in a little bit. The side that got played was I Need Some Kind of Something. And you said that you did shows in Chicago and in Milwaukee. Is that correct? Because Jim Porter hooked up some shows in Chicago.
Yes, to promote the record, yes.
Do you remember where you did shows and like what the shows were like with you and Betty?
No, I don't remember.
But you had a different sort of act than you did with the Highliners, right? It was like Peaches and Herb or Marvin and Tammy type of thing, right?
Yeah, Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell.
So did you do covers of some of those male female duet types of songs?
Yeah, what comes to mind? Where is the love you said with mine on mine?
Was that Donnie and Roberta?
Yes.
Okay. So one thing that's strange about that record is that song got released twice and on two labels. And
yes.
One version had horns and one version didn't. The version we just played, well, I haven't played any version yet, but the record we were just talking about credits Billy and Betty, and then there's another record that just credits the Soulful Twins, and it's the same song. The Billy and Betty version has horns on it. The Soulful Twins doesn't. Do you remember what the story is, which one came first?
The one without the horns, and I remember... I think he didn't even release the one without the horns until later, right away, and then added the horns and told me that that's the one he's going to stick with, Jim Porter.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of stuff that Jim did had horns on it because there were like a bunch of bands he worked with. So What's the story with the second record by the Soulful Twins? Did you change your name, or what happened?
I remember Jim asking me to duplicate my voice. Oh, and I can't let you go, the flip side of some kind of something. And I tried my best to follow my own voice, but I was like either before or after or right on time. And Jim started laughing. And he said, "Boy, that's soulful." I thought at first that he just was a little disappointed at me. But he said, "That's soulful. I'm going to call you guys the Soulful Twins." And that's how that name came about.
Okay. So you're talking about overdubbing your voice?
Yes, on another track.
Okay. So was that record, I Can't Let You Go, recorded around the same time, or was the first record released and then you went back to the studio to record it?
Yeah, we went back to it at another time. I believe a week or a couple of weeks later, he would give me the music, and I'd go. Following, we'd come back with a melody and words, and we would record it.
Okay. Do you remember where you did the recording in Chicago? Like what studio, or you just know that Jim set it up?
No, I don't recall.
Okay. So that's
I think it was Telfi.
Telfi, yeah. It does say a Telfi production on it, so it's probably that same studio. So that second record by the Soulful Twins, did it come out soon after the Billy and Betty record?
I believe a month or two later, yes. It came out pretty quick.
Okay. And it came out on a label called Sable, which I know wasn't Jim Porter's label, but it looks like on the record that he licensed it because it says a Telfi production. You don't know anything about how it got on the other label, do you?
No, I don't.
But did so your second release was I Can't Let You Go, is that correct?
That's correct.
Did that get any radio play?
Yes, it did.
Was it a bigger hit than the first record?
I do not know. I really didn't bother trying to keep up with the airplay, just trying to prepare for live performance.
Okay.
You know, and get ready, me and Betty, to have put a show on.
Were you and Betty doing more shows than you did with the Highliners, or were you still just every weekend you were doing shows?
Well, we did more. If you don't mind me giving you a little story of one time where we were performing at a local club, a few blocks from where I lived, they said they were going to have a talent show one weekend. And I asked Betty, I said, "Do you want to go?" And she said, "I don't care." I said, "Well, we should get some exposure." And she said she would. And then when I went to get her, couldn't find her. And I was disappointed, so I just didn't go. And the next day, I asked somebody, who won the show? Who won the contest? And they said, "Some little midget." They were talking about Michael Jackson.
They called him. They didn't realize he was a kid, or they were just
right.
Okay,
yeah, he's about 8 or 9 years old.
Okay. Well, yeah, they. I guess they won talent shows all over where they went.
Yeah, everywhere they went.
But it would have been cool if you had competed against them, though. That would have been pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, as Billy and Betty, did you perform in the same types of clubs that you did as the Highliners? Like, they were still mainly black clubs in Milwaukee?
No, me and Betty branched out farther outskirts of Milwaukee and better upscale clubs.
So you actually started to play for white audiences?
Yes, we did.
Do you remember the names of some of the clubs?
No, I do not.
Okay. But were there a lot of them in Milwaukee?
Yes. I you know, about 100, let's say, I can't think how to explain to you right now the distance that you would have to travel. Most blacks did not go out that far out of town, but I felt that we needed that kind of exposure, and we did get it.
Okay. And were the shows any – how did the shows and audience differ at the white clubs?
Well, the pay was better. They seemed to appreciate us greatly, treated us like we were stars.
And were they, like, more upscale, too? Like, people were dressed nicer and were the dinner clubs?
Oh, yes.
Okay. But you still mainly did it in Milwaukee and in the surrounding areas, is that correct?
That's correct.
Did you ever travel with Betty?
Yes, but not much. She dropped, lost interest for some reason or another, and I stopped, you know, worrying about her. Just went on my own.
Okay, so let me play the second record you did, and then we can talk more. So this is the Soulful Twins, and this track is called I Can't Let You Go. Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM, Chicago. If you are just tuning in, that was the Soulful Twins, a.k.a. Billy and Betty, with their second record that was called I Can't Let You Go. And I have on the phone right now Billy Miller of Billy and Betty and the Soulful Twins. Billy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so that record also got some play on the radio, correct?
Yes, it did. It got a lot of airplay.
And I was just telling you on the phone just now that in England they have a scene called the Northern Soul scene where they play up-tempo records that they can dance to, and that record was kind of like a favorite, or at least a popular one on the scene over there. So there's still people appreciating your music over the world, around the world today.
Great news.
And I actually did. I didn't even know until talking to you, and I'm sure almost no one else knew that Billy and Betty were a Milwaukee act and not a Chicago act. So that's interesting, because you had so almost all your records came out on Chicago labels.
Yeah, because that's where we recorded most of them.
So do you remember how long you stayed together with Betty after that record came out?
Shortly.
Okay, so you broke up soon after the record came out.
Yeah, I would say maybe a year, so year and a half.
And what happened? Did Betty go solo? Did she decide not that she didn't want to do?
She said, if I can remember, she said she was going to retire. She had three or four kids, raising them by herself. And so it was a lot of stress and strain on her. I understood that. And because I have six kids and six or seven that I didn't let that hold me back as much as it did her, because I was just my passion. I had to go. I had to sing.
Yeah, plus you probably weren't a single father, were you?
No.
Okay, so, like, you had more resources to take care of your kids, too.
Yeah, that's correct.
I was actually talking to somebody who listened to the interview last week, and they said they remembered seeing you guys perform in Chicago, and they're talking about what a good singer they remembered Betty was. They said she was just an awesome singer. After the group broke up, what happened? Did you continue to sing? What was the next musical thing you did?
I believe I was searching to get involved with a band and ran across this ad in the Milwaukee Journal looking for a lead vocalist. And I answered that ad, and that's how I became involved with a group called Brethren.
So, you don't remember what year that was, do you?
I'm guessing 72, 73.
Okay. So, so they just took out an ad in the paper saying they were looking for a lead vocalist, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Who were Brethren? Like, what kind of band were they in? What was their deal?
Ten-piece band. I think we had four or five brass instruments in a rhythm section. And they were young high school students, similar to John Condo's and them. But these guys were a lot better. And that's how we got to doing stuff like, what was that, Power, Bless, what is that, Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
In Chicago, probably.
In Chicago, yeah. We do stuff like that.
Yeah, like Horn Rock was really big in the Midwest, especially centered around Chicago around that time.
Yeah, we did some Beatles stuff, too.
So were the band like all white kids in high school?
Yes, that's correct.
So you were the only African American member of the band?
Yes.
And you were you the only singer?
No, the lead guitar player, he did Johnny B. Goode and maybe, you know, a couple other songs, but I did 95% of the lead.
Do you remember the names of any of the members of Brethren?
I only remember two. the leader of the band, Jeff Stowe. And he would arrange the horns the way it was recorded. And I remember the bass player, because the bass player and myself had come pretty close. He invited me up to his house. None of the others did. And we'd hang out. Al Gigani. He was an Italian.
Okay. And so what did you have to audition for them, or you just met them saying that they, did they know your records already? What was the deal?
I auditioned.
And then they're like, okay, you're our new singer?
Yes, yes.
So
right away, let's get going.
So what happened? Did you start doing shows right away? Did you have to practice with them for a while?
No, we started doing shows right away. I think they had connections, and they just needed a lead vocalist.
And they were still in high school all at the time?
Yes.
So I assume you did different types of shows than you did Billy and Betty and Billy and the Highlanders. Like, what were the shows like? I guess you already talked a little bit. You did, like, Blood, Sweat, and Tears type material?
The top 15 hit songs of the day. I remember doing some Al Green, Billy Paul, me and Mrs. Jones. And we did a show up in Sault Ste. Marie, Canada. And I remember some female fan came up during our break and said, "Did you record that song?" I said, "No." And I said, "Why are you asking me that?" She said, "I heard somebody say your name is Billy." I said, "Yeah." "Well, then I know that's you." "Don't worry about it." And I felt that was a, you know, to me it was an honor for her to think that.
Yeah.
I really liked that song, you know, and would get into it.
So, from the story you just told, it sounds like you did a lot more shows and traveled a lot more with the group Brethren. Is that correct?
Brethren, boy, we were busy. We would be. I'll give you some names. All over Wisconsin, Eau Claire, Wausau, Green Bay, Appleton, Fond du Lac, Madison, Milwaukee. Matter of fact, Madison, we were performing at this upscale supper club called the Left Guard, owned by two of the Green Bay Packers football players of the first and second Super Bowl teams. And that night, someone came in and said that Otis Redding had just, and some of his band got killed in the it was right close to the club, and I thought, "Oh wow, am I going to be able to get home?" And I barely made it back to Milwaukee myself. I took my time, and cars was all off the highway, and that's kind of scary. But
you said there was a storm. There was a big storm or something. Is that why?
Yeah, it was bad.
But did Brethren, did you all travel together? Like, do you have, like, a big bus or van? Like, how did it work?
I usually traveled by myself because those guys being a lot younger than me, 7 or 8 years younger, and would like music that wasn't really of my taste. They would listen to it, you know. And so I traveled pretty much by myself, and that's why I was by myself that night.
because you didn't like the music they played in the car. So it sounds almost like you were, like, segregated from the group, even though you were part of the group. Like, was there? It wasn't. Was that the case, or what was happening?
That wasn't the reason. Mainly, like I said, because of them being much younger than me.
Okay.
They act quite foolish and, you know, immature, and their taste in music, that's why. So they would get together early, and I had a job, still trying to hold on to a day job till I couldn't handle it anymore. And so I would, you know, drive by myself and get there in time to do what I had to do.
Okay. So how are you getting all these shows all of a sudden? Do they have, like, a really good manager or something?
I bet you I don't. I think it was Jeff Stoll's parents, father or somebody that was booking us. And once they were union, and once you get join a union, then that helps you to get good jobs and all connections.
So you're saying they were actually union musicians, like they were professional, pretty much.
Yeah, that's true. That's correct.
So you were doing music almost full time at that point?
Yes, that is right.
So, like, what would happen? Would you every day go to a different club, or what was the story?
Well, these two Green Bay Packers football players, they had, like I said, separate clubs in all the major cities, and we would go and perform 6 days a week and then have Sunday to get to the next destination and do the same thing 6 days a week.
So you couldn't, how could you even hold down a job? You were doing music full time pretty much, right?
Like I said, I had a stroke.
Okay. Like you were working in the day and then driving somewhere at night with something like that?
That's before we started working for the left guard, you know.
Who were the football players, do you remember?
Yes, Max McGee was a safety. He was a receiver. And Fuzzy Thurston was a lineman. I remember Paul Horney was a halfback, and he came up to me one time and said, "Man, you're a great singer." I said, "Coming from you, thank you a lot, you know, because I remember seeing him on TV before we started performing at those supper clubs."
So it was like a great compliment coming from a famous person like him.
Yes, that's true. Very true.
So you guys actually ended up recording a record. Were you together for a long time before the record was recorded? What's the story with that?
I think it came on pretty shortly. Plus, I don't remember too much about that either, other than Jeff gave me some music, and I came up with the other side of the music, and I wrote the words and the melody to both sides, and we recorded that in Milwaukee on Teentown label.
So, do you remember? You don't remember the name of the studio in Milwaukee or anything, do you?
I believe it was Teentown.
Oh, they had their own studio. Okay, yeah, because the label it was released on was definitely called Teentown. And let me play the record, and we can talk a little bit more. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay, so this is Brethren with Billy Miller singing lead. This track is called "Can This Be Real?"
I love
Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM, Chicago. You're listening to the City in the Park show. That was just a group called Brethren that was called Can This Be Real? And if you're just tuning in, I have lead singer of Brethren, Billy Miller, on the phone talking about his story. Billy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. So I was listening to the record, and the band sounds pretty professional on there. Were they still high school students at that point?
All but one. He was a, I think he was a trumpet. The rest of them had graduated maybe a year or so.
Okay. And that record, did it get play in Milwaukee? Did you sell it at shows? What, do you remember anything about it?
We sold them at the shows. I don't remember hearing it on the radio. But I know that there were some clubs that we went to. They had it on the jukebox.
Okay. And they didn't just, like, put it in because you were coming. Like, they were like, it was like a local jukebox hit, right?
No, they had other hits. I mean, you know, other records on the jukebox.
Okay. So how long did you stay with Brethren? Like, because that was pretty much the first time in your life that you were doing music full-time. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you must have been pretty happy, at least for a while, that you were able to actually pursue a career in what you were interested in.
Right, right. What I think happened is that disco started getting popular, and people didn't want to play. They said it's too expensive to have bands, and so we disbanded. I don't know what happened to those guys, but... I decided my kids were born in a big city. I wanted them to experience a small city. And so we moved here to Anderson, Indiana.
So the, but before, so disco pretty much that happened to a lot of groups. That probably happened around 75, something like that, because that's when disco really broke and like a lot of singing groups and bands kind of broke up because disco was more like a studio thing. Do you remember, do you think you broke up around 75?
I would say 74.
Okay. So, I'm sorry I cut you off. So you were talking about you wanted your kids to live somewhere else?
Well, to experience a small town, you know, so when they become adults, they'd have experience of both large and small. And now all of them live in a big city.
So, at least, well, they got the choice now. So where did you move to?
Anderson, Indiana.
And
let me say this. My youngest son, Gregory, and my oldest son, Anthony, they played with Brethren at the Left Guard one time because I asked the band would they let them do that. And that place was packed. You couldn't move, you know. And they really, really loved what they did. Gregory danced with me. And Anthony drummed. Took over the drums, and he was 10 years old, something like that, 10 or 11, and Gregory was 5 or 6. So all my kids are very talented, but they're not, you know, they don't have the passion, or maybe they just put that on the back burner because they got families, you know, too.
Yeah, it's hard to make a living with music. It's a tough lifestyle.
Yes, it is very hard.
So... You moved to Anderson, Indiana around 75, 74?
70, but I spent 10 years here.
So 76?
Yes.
And you told me originally you were from Muncie, Indiana?
Yes, about 20 miles west of Muncie.
You're saying Anderson is 20 miles west of Muncie?
Yes.
So you just pretty much moved back home almost.
Yes, that's true.
Did you still have family back home?
I'm getting married to my childhood sweetheart, would you believe? She was 4 and I was 5 years old. And we lived a block apart. And I've been courting her. She lives in Dayton, Ohio. And she loves music too, so... When we get married, September 3rd, we're going to start doing some music. She has written a song that I'm going to have this band, blues band that I'm with, to record it for me. And I'm with two different bands, one that plays rock, country, blues, and contemporary Christian music, and then I'm with this blues band, so... I'm definitely still into music.
So, first of all, congratulations. But we're skipping a bunch of your career, actually, because you did a bunch of stuff with other groups, too. Like, what I was asking, actually, was when you were... we'll get back to what you're talking about now, the different bands you're in now. But when you first moved back to Anderson, did you have any family back there, or you were just moving all your kids and yourself back there?
Yeah, well, my sister... under me, Margie Fly. She still lived in the house that we lived in Muncie. At that time, another sister lived here, Tina, and so that's why I just stayed here.
So, did you have a job lined up there, and how did...
Yes, I had a job, and working in as a core maker in the foundry. We came down on vacation, and my ex, she worked for Social Security office claim representative, so we had things pretty much ready for us when we got here.
Okay, cool. So did you get involved with... how long before you got involved with music once you moved there?
A few weeks. I heard a band, music coming from back of a house in the garage, and went to the look and see what there was happening, and walked in, and these guys finished their song and then asked me who was I, and I told them I'm a singer and I liked what they were doing. Could I sing something with them? And they said yes. They were gospel group, and we did an album called Heaven at Last about a year later.
So what was the name of the group again?
Truth and Devotion, and we did an album called Heaven at Last.
So when did you run into them? Like, how long were you in Anderson before you ran into the guys from Truth and Devotion?
78, I think. 77 or 78.
And you're used to hearing about gospel groups as vocal harmony groups, but they were actually a band doing gospel. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And How did you run into them? It wasn't at church, right? You just ran into them practicing somewhere?
Yes, yes, in a garage.
They lived near you?
Near my sister. But let me say this, if you don't mind. I went on a vacation to California, and I had a friend that lived in Muncie, sister that moved out there, and he moved out there, and his sister lived next door to one of the ink spots, and she introduced me to him, and he said, "I heard you're a singer. Sing me something." So I got my guitar and sung a song. He said, "Do you know any platter songs?" I said, "Yes, I know quite a few." Sang me something, I did, and he said, he got on the phone and called somebody in and said, "Go out to Disneyland. They'll be waiting for you." I didn't know who they were, but I got there and they said, "Only you." And I said, "Yes." I sung that with them. When I got through singing, they said, "We're getting ready to go on tour tomorrow. Can you go?" I said, "I'm on vacation with my family. I can't do that." They couldn't get back by themselves. And if they did, I'd be afraid that something would happen to them. But I did get the opportunity to sing with them and put a tour with them and probably record when they came back off a tour.
So you sang pretty much one show with...
One song
with some... Was it Buck Rams Platters? Who's, like, what version of the play?
It was Tony Williams, the lead vocalist. He had parted, separated from the rest of them and started another Platter group. And so they needed someone to take his voice or sing his lead. And that's what I would have been doing with the rest of the originals. Herb Reed, I believe, was the two founders with Tony Williams of the Platters. He's the one that told me, could I go on tour with him.
But you had to turn it down because your family was on vacation with you?
Yes.
But you would have had a chance to do music professionally again, like full-time, if you had done that, right?
Oh, man, I've been with one of the greatest groups around.
But you didn't want to go back home and then travel and leave your family behind, right?
That's right. I couldn't have lived with myself if something had happened to them, so I turned it down.
So then after that was when you met the gospel band Truth and Devotion?
Yes. Came back to Anderson, and that's how I got involved with them, hearing them from the street.
And you started singing, just singing with them, and they were playing, and did they sing too?
Yes.
Do you remember any of the members of that band?
Yes. Horace Brooks, John Hester, Garland Simmons, Mickey Edgar Woodall, myself, Dwayne Johnson, who's passed, Bobby Simon, and James Dixon.
And you ended up recording, before you recorded an album, which you mentioned, you ended up recording a single. Is that correct?
That's correct. On Champ Label, America's oldest black gospel label. We recorded that in Nashville, Tennessee. I would say that was around 79. And then we got with Ty Scott record label and did this album in 81.
So how did you get the Champ single? I was trying to remember before when I was talking to you on the phone at home, like the owner of Champ, and I think one of the guys, his name was Style Wooten. Do you remember that person?
No, Jim Stanton is the one that I remember.
Okay. And was he the person that hooked up the recording?
He was the engineer.
So... And do you remember how you got hooked up with him? Was it just one of the band members hooked it up somehow?
I don't remember. I don't remember how we got hooked up, but because it was gospel and Nashville wasn't very far for us to travel, Ty Scott didn't exist. We went to Tennessee.
Okay, and you recorded that record. Did anything happen with it?
No, I don't think so.
And so I don't actually talk to a lot of people who sang with like professional gospel groups, just in church mainly. Did you actually start doing shows?
Yes, we did. We went to Kansas City, Kansas. We opened a show for James Cleveland here in Anderson. We opened a show. I mean, we sung at Al Green's church, and then Al Green asked us to come to Cincinnati and open the program for him there, but he didn't allow us to do anything, and I lost respect for the man because he said the Spirit of God, you don't quench the Spirit, and that's why time ran out, and he didn't have time for us to do anything. And so we had to turn around and come back. Oh. Had to, you know, pay for our gas money to come back. At least they could have done that, gave us gas money to come home.
Yeah. So, like, what were gospel venues like? Were they at big, were they at clubs, like the same kinds of clubs? Were they mainly at churches? Like, where did the gospel shows happen?
We did universities. We did Lester Sumrall TV show. And I think the first Black Expo program that they had. We did schools around here in Anderson and stuff like that.
And how often were you performing?
Pretty regular.
What does that mean, like once a week? What does that mean?
Almost every Sunday.
Okay. So was there like a church service and you would perform, or you'd perform at night?
Programs Sunday afternoon.
Like right after church, pretty much.
Yeah.
And you said, so that you cut your original 45, like 78, 79, and then you ended up cutting an album in 81. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
What's the story with that? How did that happen?
Well, Dr. Leonard Scott, which is a dentist, he started his own label, and he had one group, and he was looking for another, and we found that out because we wanted to record, and so we recorded on his label. And today, Ty Scott Corporation is a big-time national recording company, and at that time, they didn't have no distribution company and nor connection.
So they just formed it around that time and signed you to record?
Yes.
Where were they located?
Indianapolis, Indiana.
Okay. So did you go down there to record?
Yes, we did.
And you said it was owned by a dentist?
Yes, Dr. Leonard Scott.
How did you get hooked up with him?
We went to his office and talked to him. I was the manager of the group, and someone else, I think Edgar Woodall, he's now pastor of church here in Anderson, and he came and listened to us, and that's how we got on his label.
But you said he didn't really have any distribution, so not much happened with the record?
No. But it's still on the internet. And I remember reading that somebody said the album led them to the Lord.
That's pretty awesome.
Yes, it is.
So how long did Truth and Devotion stay together?
We parted in 84, I think, because I remember Motown 25th anniversary. We got together and watched that show on TV, and because most of the guys worked in the automotive industry and they were moving the jobs away, some of them had to move to keep their job, and so the group disbanded because of that. But John Hester and myself, he didn't work for the auto industry, and me and him started a group, and And I was wanting to have a female sing with us and found someone that was going to Ivy Tech College like myself. And her name was Valerie. And we became Radiance, and we would sing at juke joints and in the community. We didn't do nothing more than that. We did never did record. It's just more just like staying in the music and singing behind karaoke CDs of hit records.
And that was in Anderson?
Yes, in Indianapolis.
Okay. But you weren't a gospel group anymore. You were just a bit kind of a band. And
yes, that's right.
Or you weren't even a band. You were just singers, and you said you sang to karaoke backing tracks.
That's right.
And so did you do any music stuff after that? What happened?
Well, right now I'm with two bands, a Circle City Blues Band out of Indianapolis, and a group out of Tipton, Indiana, like I said before, called Nation. And so I'm still in music, doing music.
How did you join each of those groups?
With Circle City Blues Band, I went to Indianapolis to look, try to get involved with a band. And I went to a club that was called the Cotton Club, did the jazz music, and asked the guys on their break, could I do a song with them? And they said I could. And when I got through singing this one or two songs, some guy came up, followed me to the bathroom. And made me feel a little uneasy, so I hurried up and hit it out of there. And he came out and followed me back to the table and said, "What are your interests in singing?" I said, "I'm trying to find a band." He said, "Well, I know a fantastic band," and he gave me the name of Johnny Scarsborough, and that's how we come together. I named us Circle City Blues Band because they were all from Indianapolis, and I was close to it, so that's how that name came about. And we don't work regularly, but enough keep me busy with this other group.
Okay.
This other group, if you don't mind me saying, three of us came from a group that was called Linda Lee and the Noble Creek Band, and we did a CD with her here in Anderson, 2009, and that helped her to get on a national label. But the three of us, we left and started Nation with three other guys.
So occasionally you do shows with Nation, and occasionally you do shows with the Circle City Blues Band. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Have you recorded and released any material with either band?
Me and Johnny has recorded some original stuff. I don't know. I believe it's still on the Internet. It was first on the garage.band.
Who's Johnny?
Johnny Scarsborough.
Okay. He's in the Circle City. He's the lead of the Circle City Blues Band.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And we did. I don't know. Like I said, what's on there now? Johnny could tell you, but we did a song called "World Peace" under the name of Fast Johnny Blues Band, and that was last I heard, 2006 or 7, out of a top 100 songs called "A World" in it. We come in 81, and that, to me, was something to be proud of. I do stuff for senior citizens by myself every year at Muncie Fairgrounds, and I'm looking forward to that, and that's usually in May. I also do some stuff at festivals called Farmer's Pike out of Newcastle, Indiana. So I'm, again, I try to stay busy with music, my passion.
Yeah, it's remarkable that over so many years you were able to continue to be very active in music. Like most groups I talk to, like people, they do it for a while and they get discouraged because it's so hard to be successful and they kind of give up. But you've managed to stay involved pretty much your whole life, or at least since you started.
My mom died singing Peace in the Valley. My sister said she wrote it and it was stolen, but that's neither here nor there. She, you ask her to sing, she would sing at the top, you know, just any time of day or night, and died singing. I probably do the same thing. I'm not going to stop singing. I'll sing until the day I leave here.
And you're actually, you're still active too. You're getting married now, right?
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
So congratulations on that too. So is there anything else that people should be looking out for from you?
Yes, a book being written by me, by my life experience in music, by a lady named Linda Klein out of Dunkirk, Indiana. And I'm looking forward to that, having that completed, because that's pretty much about my whole family, you know, and that DNA of music. So hopefully people will be interested in it and look it up when it gets finished. It's probably titled America Bell, Thank You for the Torch That Swells Up in Within Billy G. Mel as well.
Okay. And is there anything else you want to talk about before we finish?
No, I could talk to you a lot more, but I know time is running out.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you telling your story. You have a really interesting story about being in all types of different groups in different genres across like many decades. So it's really interesting kind of hearing. It's like hearing the story of a singer from, you know, what they have to do from the 60s through today. So it was really interesting.
Well, I thank you very much for being interested.
And you don't have any, do you have any last words for the listening audience?
Stick to your passion, because this music is soothing to your soul. It's the greatest blessing and medicine for the soul.
Yeah, that's definitely good advice. So thanks again for telling your story. It was great. And this last record I'm going to play is the B-side of your very first record by the Inspirations. This track is called I'll Take a Chance on You. So thanks again, Billy.
Thank you.
Okay, here's the song.
To be or not to be, yes, to be loved or not to be. Hearts that love fulfills and the pleasure of it all. Oh, as far as I can recall, that's why the decision that I made on you. Darling, so real.
Okay, that was just the Inspirations, which was Billy Miller's first group with I'll Take a Chance on You. And Billy had one more thing to talk about to the audience. Is that right?
Yes. You seem to have pretty good connection. I wrote a song about my youngest daughter, Yvette, and Weaver, and I wrote titled it Pretty Little Sweet Things. And maybe you can check and see if anybody recorded the song. And also, you were invited to the wedding August 3rd.
Okay.
To my childhood sweetheart, Mildred Marie Brown. So that's all I had to say.
Okay, well, congratulations again, and thanks again for the interview.